The following shiur has been presented by Rav Yitzchak Grossman, Dayan at the Beis Havad, and has been brought to you by the Beis Havad Halacha Center.
This volume has been graciously dedicated by Reb Shimshon and Reb Yehuda Beanstock and families in honor of their parents, Max and Gail Beanstock of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. May the merit of the Torah studied through this volume bring them and their families continued gesunt, nachas and parnasa berevach, ad meah ve'esrim shana.
Ksuvos daf pei. In our previous lecture for daf ayin tes, we discussed the scenario, ubiquitous in the context of modern marriages, where a husband places assets, such as a house, loans, other assets, in his wife's name, either totally in her name or jointly in both their names, and the question arises whether the woman is thereby entitled to the appropriate share of the assets, either all the assets or a joint share of the assets, by virtue of this documentation, either because the documentation in her name constitutes proof that the purchase of these assets was funded by her funds, by her assets, or because the documentation itself constitutes a matana, a gift, a transfer of the assets to her by her husband. In that lecture, we discussed the classic sources, the Rishonim, the early major Achronim, discussing this, Alpi, the Sugyas of the Gemara. In this lecture, the second part in the series, we discuss the same question from the perspective of the modern poskim, who deal with modern realia, modern culture, the conduct of spouses in modern marriages, the nature of real estate, titling, and deeds. So we'll begin with a discussion of two or three important 19th century tshuvas on the topic, and then move to some discussion of later 20th century poskim discussing these sorts of questions. Widely quoted is a passage, two passages actually, in Aruch HaShulchan. Baruch HaShulchan, in Siman Samach, and Siman Samach Beis, and Choshen Mishpat, after discussing some of the comments of the early poskim on this, he adds as follows. Yesh l'daktek ata, that today we have to be very careful when property is written al shem ha'isha ba'ar koseyem in non-Jewish courts, even though the property is put in her name in legal documents, the dayanim have to be very careful. Tzrichim ha'dayanim lios masun, patient, careful, because l'pa'amim, occasionally, the husband will put property in his wife's name if ne'ezah ta'amim for certain reasons. Doesn't specify what they are, presumably legal reasons, tax reasons, other sorts of reasons, possibly legal reasons, maybe not so legal reasons, whatever the reasons are, really the nechasim are of the husband, and he may have put them in her name for these unspecified, mysterious reasons. L'chein tzrichim lachar b'zeh harbe. It is the Beis Din's job not to simply rely on doctrine handed down by the earlier poskim. It is the Beis Din's job to investigate well what did the husband really mean when he put the assets in her name legally. The Aruch HaShulchan follows up, Kvar bi'arnu, that at bizmanenu, in our time, there is no raya, he says, ein shum raya, from the fact that karkos, the real estate in particular, is put in the woman's name, even if it's niskayim barkos, even if it's registered formally in their court, because many people do that. Again, these unspecified mysterious reasons. There are many times people do this for these mysterious reasons. They do not thereby mean to transfer title of the property to their wives. And again, here he adds, they have to be really, really very, very careful to make sure that they arrive at the proper conclusion of what the husband really did mean by putting the assets in his wife's name. In the Divrei Malkiel, of Rav Malkiel Tenenbaum, he has a tshuva about a husband who put a rechayim, not a residence, not residential property, but a mill, a commercial property, basically, in his wife's name. The woman was not a noses, in a sense, p'tocha bayis. She was not involved in the household finances. And he put this rechayim three quarters in her name. Shlosha chalakim al shem ishto, mizivuk sheni, second wife. And subsequently, the man died, and the woman wanted her three quarters of the rechayim. She said, the shtar is in my name, so I want it. So the Divrei Malkiel takes for granted, since she's not noseset b'nesen b'tocha bayis. In our previous lecture, we discussed that one of the reasons of the Rashba for saying the shtar doesn't prove anything is because whenever a woman is noseset b'nesen b'tocha bayis, whenever she manages the household finances, the fact that property is in her name doesn't prove anything because she has management control. She has access. So it might be in her name. So the Divrei Malkiel says here she was not noses b'nesenet b'tocha bayis, so we take for granted, with very little ado, very little discussion, that the shtar does indeed convey right, title, ownership of the property to her. The problem is, Reb Malkiel then devotes a paragraph to discussing how exactly this kinyan worked. In other words, he does not assume necessarily that it was purchased with her funds. That wasn't what she was claiming. She was simply claiming that by virtue of the shtar, she should have the right to 3/4 of the property. So he gets into a technical discussion of what kinyan would have worked. Maybe the Baal made a kinyan chazak in the Rechayim on behalf of her. Maybe the shtar itself is a kinyan. The problem is, he says, the shtar was never received by the woman. A normal shtar kinyan in halacha has to be received by the kana. That's how the kinyan is made. The buyer, the person acquiring the property, receives the shtar. The woman never received the shtar. It was simply registered in court in her name. Why is that a kinyan? Maybe that's a kinyan situmta, he says. Since minhag ha-sochrim, the common commercial practice, the legal regime, the commercial practice was dinas malchusa, he says, it is a kinyan. It's like situmta. Maybe the shtar is kana. So he goes back and forth discussing whether it's a kinyan or not, but he takes for granted that the shtar does indeed, should indeed convey title to the woman. The only question is whether there was a proper kinyan. In the tshuvas of the Beis Yitzchak, Rabbi Yitzchak Shmelkish, he discusses also a similar question. He discusses the basic question of a husband who puts property in his wife's name. So he brings the machlokas and the Rishonim, whether a normal shtar, a shtar in the time of Chazal, or the Rishonim, does indeed convey title to the woman or not. In his case, he was discussing not the classic shtar of Chazal, where the seller or the person giving the gift gave a shtar written al pi halacha to the recipient, to the buyer, but rather he was discussing the tabala, the tablitzia, the tabu, many different names we find for this arrangement in the Achronim, in modern Israeli poskim, some kind of system of land registry where a person would go formally to some government agency or a court, and he would deed over the property to the person who was acquiring the property. So he discusses what is the status of this intabalitirin, this tabala, this land registry, what is the status of this al pi halacha? So he brings the machlokas rishonim, and then he says that even the Rashba was the great opinion who held that the shtar itself, a normal shtar, a classic shtar of the time of Chazal, of the time of the Rishonim, doesn't constitute any proof. The shtar could have been written for numerous other reasons. The shtar could have been written similar to what the Aruch HaShulchan says. The shtar might have been written for ulterior motives, but not meant to convey actual right or actual title. Says the Beis Yitzchak, these types of svaras do not apply to the formal intabalitia in the land registry. He says, because the main svara of the Rashba was L'Gluy Yezuzit. The Rashba brought a Gemara that sometimes when a husband makes a deal with his wife, he's only doing it not to actually give her, to sell her the property he's transferring to her. He wants her to reveal to him where her hidden assets are. He has the right to those assets, at least in Nichsim Malug. He wants to discover where she's hiding her money from him. So he pretends to sell her karka in order to discover where her assets are. Says the Beis Yitzchak, that made sense when we're dealing with Beis and Shal Yisrael. We're dealing with a shtar that would be enforced and dealt with by Beis and Shal Yisrael. The husband could say, I gave her this bogus shtar. I knew when we came to Beis Din, they would learn the Gemara, they would see that a shtar written by a husband is L'Gluy Yezuzi. Beis Din will force her to give me back the shtar. If it was a question of putting loans, securities in her name, Beis Din will force her to turn over the securities to him. That's all fine when we're dealing with a Beis Din Shel Yisrael. We're dealing with a system in which we have control. However, he says, this type of tabala, this land registry, that's done according to their laws and their systems, Beis Din has no power at all to alter, to manipulate a deed, the title of land. He must have meant Matana Gemura, because what else could he possibly have meant? What else could he possibly have meant by putting it in her name? He knew he'd have no control. He knew, what was his whole goal? To get her to turn over her hidden cash from her piggy bank to him. Now she has the land, and the title will never be extracted from her grasp. So Al Karchuk, there's no Sfar of L'Gluy Yezuzi, and therefore such a shtar, according to everyone, he says, does constitute a clear intent on the part of the husband to genuinely, authentically transfer the property to her, and it's not merely a sham, L'Gluy Yezuzi. As we noted in the previous lecture, some posts can say that the Rashba point out the Rashba has other reasons why the shtar is only a sham. He might have other motives. He doesn't want to seem rich. He doesn't want property in his name, for creditors, for other reasons. The Beit Yitzchak seems to feel that in the standard basic case, this is the only reason by default we're concerned with, and if there's no Sfar of L'Gluy Yezuzi, because in the official land registry of the government, if there's no such svara, then she would indeed be entitled to the property. However, he says that's only, he does concede there is another possibility of havracha. We began this whole series on Dafayin Ches and Ayin Tes with the idea of havracha, that sometimes people make sham transfers of property to avoid the creditors getting control of their assets. So all this, he says, with a land registry is a registration is a raya that he actually means her to have the property. That's only true when there's no umdana that he means to mavriach. When from the context, we don't know that he was trying to avoid creditors. He says, in a case where there is a real chashash of creditors, that he was doing it to avoid his creditors, then in Achinami, we would say that even if he went to the trouble of actually putting the property, titling and deeding it to her, then it wouldn't make a difference insofar as we're concerned with Havracha, then we would not say that the title is a riot to her. We would indeed give him back the property. This question is then discussed very heavily by 20th century poskim, notably in Eretz Yisrael, Dayanim for the Rabbanut. We have everyone from Rav Shlomo Tenner, Rav Yitzchak Herzog, Rav Eliashiv, Rav Eliezer Goldschmidt, Rav Shmuel Shapiro, Rav Avram Atlas, many others, many, many tshuvas from the Piskei Din of the Rabbanut. Many tshuvas discussing this basic question of how do we deal with property that was put in the wife's name by the husband, registered formally in the land registry or just put in her name by other types of contracts. How do we deal with such shtaros in the event of a dissolution of the marriage? Do we say, al pi rishonim, do we discuss Ligluy Zuzi, the classic concerns, and sometimes take the shtar at face value? Do we follow the Aruch HaShulchan and say that we have to be very careful not to get it wrong? We have to be very careful to consider what other ulterior motives there may be. In general, it seems there isn't a clear, consistent, absolute consensus among the poskim, but it seems the Sugin D'Alma, it seems the most common approach is to work at least somewhat with the Aruch HaShulchan and to say that insofar as Libenu, Libi Omerli, insofar as it really seems that the husband never really meant to put the property in her name, then we will not necessarily give her the property. Though again, poskim take different attitudes. Some focus more on the Rishonim, some focus more on the Aruch HaShulchan type language and just say that we have to investigate, we have to draw our own conclusions on whether the husband really meant to put the property in her name or was simply doing it for ulterior motives. There's a tshuva in the Birka Shlomo, of Rav Shlomo Tena. He discusses a case where the husband had put property in his wife's name. He pretty much takes for granted that we will consider the shtar as a riot to her. He begins his tshuva by bringing the discussion of the Rishonim. He says, when the Rishonim discuss, as we keep pointing out, when the Rishonim discuss accepting the shtar at face value and giving her title to the property, there are two possible svaras. One of them is as proof that she actually funded the purchase of the property. Two, even if we know that the husband funded it, he says, maybe the mere act of putting it in her name, that in itself constitutes a transfer to her. In our previous share, we noted that most of the classic poskim don't seem to assume that latter possibility. They only seem to consider the first possibility, the Rishonim, that maybe she actually bought it, maybe it was bought with her funds. But Orim V'Tumim says that there are actually Rishonim that say that the shtar itself constitutes a transfer of the property to her, even if it was not funded by her, even if there was no previous transfer, the shtar itself constitutes a transfer, similarly to what the Divrei Malchiel seem to be discussing. And indeed, one of the many tshuvas of the Rabbanit in the Piskei Din, by Rabbi Yashiv, along with other Dayanim, claims that the Rav Tumim, the Rush that the Tumim brings is not a Das Yachid. He claims that there are actually major Rishonim, a group of major Rishonim, who held that the shtar itself put in someone else's name, that in and of itself, whether to one's wife or to anybody else, the mere fact of titling property to somebody else entitles that person to the property. And you can't say, I only did it for a sham for some reason. If you put a shtar in that person's name, that person is entitled to the property. Now, the Birka Shlomo brings both these possibilities, either that the shtar in the woman's name is proof that she funded the purchase, or that it itself constitutes a transfer of property to her. So he says that, in his particular case, he's not interested in the second possibility that the shtar itself constitutes a transfer, because he says that in the context of his case, of a get and a woman who was saying ma'asalah, she would have to return any gifts that she got. This in and of itself is a major, major topic discussed by many poskim in this context, even if we say that the husband was putting the property in her name as a gift. Maybe gifts have to be returned in the event of divorce, depends on the context of the divorce. This is a major topic beyond the scope of our lecture. In any event, in his tshuva, he says he's only going to be focusing on the first question of whether the shtar can be used as proof that the property was indeed purchased with her assets, with her funds. And he brings the Rishonim, he brings the Aruch HaShulchan, and so on. And he says we really have to investigate whether the property is really hers, or whether it was really purchased by her or not, just because the shtar is in her name, that is not the be-all and end-all. He brings the Achronim, the Shach, the Sma, the Nesivis Mishpat of Rav Chaim Al-Ghazi, other poskim, Beis Yitzchak, and he seems to be inclined to say that we do follow the idea of the Aruch HaShulchan and the Beis Yitzchak, that insofar as we believe, based on the totality of the circumstances, that the shtar is in her name, that he meant to actually title the property to her, or in his case, that the shtar is meant to be proof that she actually funded the property, we would give it to her, he says, but his conclusion is, Ein lahasik shezosi yochachav adoes. It's some level of proof, but we can't consider it absolute 100% proof. In his tshuva, his primary question was, can the Baal demand a shvua from the wife, a shvua that she indeed purchased the property, it was indeed purchased with her funds. And he says, Aruch HaShulchan, Sof Kol Sof, he says, there might be a reason he put the assets in her name, so even if, al pi din, we would be inclined to follow the view that the shtar in her name grants her the right to it, but Aruch HaShulchan says it's not so simple. Particularly, he says, when Shalom Bayis, when the marital relationship is stable, it's yativ, it's hakin, nobody's thinking about it, nobody's thinking of court, nobody's bringing these kinds of riots, like the Beis Yitzchak says, if he titled it in her name, it must be that he really meant for her to keep it. And indeed, some poskim say that it's unpleasant to start writing a shtar that reflects the funding, because that implies that you're already thinking of divorce. If the husband and wife are going to sit down and say, well, your side paid for 3/4 of the house and my side paid for 1/4, so let's put the house 3/4 in my name and 1/4 in your name, that implies they're already thinking about dissolution. As long as the marriage is stable, who cares? So couples will frequently just put it in their joint names for convenience, and therefore the shtar is not such a riot. So he says, Mistaver, even if we will follow the basic language of the shtar, we will give her the property, Ein lepotrim mishvua mikbalas cheirim, we will allow the Baal to demand a shvua, or a kibalas cheirim, that is indeed the case, that she funded it with her assets. In the Sefer Mishpatecha Yaakov, by Rav Tzvi Yehuda ben Yaakov, he has a magnificent, a couple dozen pages, tshuva on this topic, where he's holich ba la'arko la'rachba, he brings everything that's been written, the earlier Akronim, the Rishonim, the early Akronim, the later Akronim, many, many tshuvas of the rabbinate. He's done mefalpel b'divrayim. And his conclusion, at the end of the day, his conclusion is that it really depends on the context. You really have to look at each case individually and see, in any given context what people really meant, what the husband and wife really meant, to the extent that we can infer that from the general context. Among the many psakim of the Rabbanut that he brings a psak of Hagra Atlas, I think that is Rabbi Avram Atlas, an unpublished psak. He talks about bank accounts. Rabbi Atlas is talking about, let's say a husband opens a joint bank account, let's say he's the primary breadwinner, he has his salary deposited into this joint account. Hayal al hadas, he says, does it make any sense at all to say he really means to grant her half a salary, he says? He's just giving away half a salary to the woman? No, he says. Similarly, a dira, which is meant a residence at least, maybe not an investment property, but at least a residence which is meant to be used by both parties, he says, and he puts it in both their names. The Baal never meant to give it as a gift to his wife. He puts it in their joint names because that's convenient or for other reasons. But you certainly can't infer from such a shtar that the husband really means to grant title of the property, half of it to his wife. He brings many other tshuvas, Rav Yashuv, Rav Herzog. One of them, one interesting tshuva is a psak din, also from the Beis Din HaGadol in Eretz Yisrael, of Rav Shmuel Shapiro, who takes for granted that Bizman Hazeh, he says, the custom is to put diras in the name of both parties, both spouses. Even the Rush, he says, even the Rush who says, the Rush wrote back in 13th or 14th century Spain, Toledo, the Rush wrote, it's not the custom of a man to put property in his wife's name unless it was actually funded by her and it's her property. That may have been true back then, he says, but today, Rav Shapiro says, where the custom certainly is that diras are put in the name of both spouses, so certainly, he says, the Rush would agree that such a shtar, a document putting the property in his wife's name, does not convey title of half the property to her. The whole reason of the Rush is people don't do that, he says. Bizman Hazeh, people certainly do that. So he says the Rush would have to agree that she's not entitled to half the property. And so on and so forth. This seems to be pretty much the consensus of many Bate Din, most Bate Din. One of the things he brings is this psak of Rav Eliashiv, a basin of Rav Eliashiv, Rabbi Eliezer Goldschmidt, another Dayan, that there the issue was primarily about the funding. There was some debate as to who funded it. So in that psak of Rav Eliashiv, the conclusion was, the way they summarized it in the beginning, for example, that in a case where the husband funded it, the Beis Din wrote that they funded it but put the document in her name, there is a machlokes rishonim, yesh poskim who say that by the mere fact that the shtar is in her name, even if he funded it, she's entitled to it. As we noted earlier, Rav Eliashiv says that although the Tumim seems to be the only one of the Akronim, the early Akronim who made this great discovery of the Rush, who says that even if she didn't fund it, by the mere fact that it's in her name, that itself entitles her to it, and even the Chuvah Rush, the other Chuvah Rush, who says that you follow the Shtar, doesn't say it because she funded, doesn't say it's because the shtar gives it to her. He says it's because she funded it. Nevertheless, the Tumim found a different shuvah Rush, who says that the mere fact of the shtar, irrespective of the funding question, even if he funded it, gives her title. And Rabbi Yashuv and his based and said that it's not the only one. There are other Rishon would say the same thing. Other major Rishon would say that. But Yesh Amrim, no. Yesh Amrim, the Baal wins. And it's, and he, and the Baal can say, I put it in her name for other reasons, and she's not entitled to it. However, if she funded it, then certainly there would be shittas that she would be entitled to it. In his case, it wasn't clear, and they avoided passing, they bring the Aruch HaShulchan, they avoided passing the actual question by saying their case was a rental, not a purchase, in which case there are different factors that come into play, and so on and so forth. There are many, many different psakim of the Rabbanut in different directions, and the conclusion of Rav Ben Yaakov, Rav Yehuda Ben Yaakov, in his sefer, he brings numerous different psakim, again, as we noted, numerous different psakim of the rabbinate in all different directions, Rav Shlomo Duchovsky, Rav Simblast. He discusses the question of Umdana. He says, you might argue that if the Baal says, I didn't really mean it, you might argue that it's only Dvar Meshebelev. He says, no, it's an Umdana, Belibo Velev Kaladam. Again, we began this whole discussion by discussing Mavrachas, the question of a person who makes a sham shtar to put his assets in someone else's name to avoid creditors getting a hold of them, to avoid a spouse getting a hold of them, and the post can say that there is such a thing as a shtar mavrachas. Even the Beit Yitzchak alludes to this. There is such a thing as a shtar mavrachas in a context in which we believe that a person didn't really mean to make the matana, then it's not binding. Here too, he says, that's what's going on here in a case where we believe, because of all the svaras we've been discussing, everything from Gluye Zuze to the general custom of married couples, to the fact that to get a mortgage sometimes you have to put the shtar in both names, there can be many reasons why we don't take seriously the fact that the shtar is in both names. So, therefore, it would not be a question of Dvar Meshebelev. It would be considered an Umdana Belibo Velev Kaladam. And Rav Ben Yaakov goes on and brings all these various poskim, Rav Uziel, Rav Herzog, and so on. And he says that the fundamental question at the end of the day is, do we really conclude, based on the shtar, that the woman is entitled to the property or not? It really depends on context, he says. Yecholol hishtanos in mikra lemikra can change from case to case. It's totally on the shikul adas, the judgment of the beis din, and its understanding in a given case of what exactly was the husband's intention. And he says, in his case, therefore, after 20 pages into his tshuva, he says, in his case, where again, he's talking about the tabo, tes aleph beis vav, the land registry, he says, when a couple puts property in the tabo in both their names, that does not constitute a raya, proof that he means to give it to her as a gift. And therefore, he says, again, it's Basin's job to determine what was actually meant, and if Basin does not feel, based on the context of the husband actually meant to give the property to his wife, we're back to the Aruch HaShulchan, that it's Basin's job to be very, very careful, to be very thoughtful, to analyze carefully what the intent of the parties was, and if we conclude that the custom, that the husband did not mean to give it to her for any of these various reasons that we have, we will not give the woman the property simply based on the fact that there are documents that the husband signed putting it in her name.
The Daf Yomi Halacha series has been brought to you by the Beis Havad Halacha Center. To sign up for the Halacha Center's weekly interactive e-journal, please email subscribe to info@thehalachacenter.org.